Good evening. The mother of Eric Garner, killed in a police chokehold as he begged for breath, testifies before Congress. What the whistleblower and national intelligence have on the Trump administration, the mystery deepens, and the antidote to Big Pharma may be a public option. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Thursday, September 19th, 2019. First, these headlines. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is pleading with voters to forgive a video and two photographs showing him in minstrel show makeup, commonly known as blackface, a racist trope. The photos are from a private school where he had been a teacher. It shows the then 29-year-old Trudeau in a turban and robe with brown makeup on his hands, face, and neck. Another photo and a video were released by political opponents that showed Trudeau in similar makeup on different occasions. Trudeau made a public apology earlier today.
I want to begin by saying a few words directly to racialized Canadians who face discrimination every single day in their lives, even in a country like Canada. What I did hurt them, hurt people who shouldn't have to face intolerance and discrimination because of their identity. This is something that I deeply, deeply regret. Darkening your face, regardless of the context or the circumstances, is always unacceptable because of the racist history of blackface. I should have understood that then, and I never should have done it. Je veux d'abord dire directement aux Canadiens qui font face à de l'intolérance.
Last night on the plane, when we asked you if that the picture that emerged in the Time report was the only time you had done this, you left us with the impression there was only one other incident. And since then, Global News has released a video which seems to show that there was at least a third incident. So exactly how many times have you darkened your skin with makeup in an act that you have yourself described as racist?
I shared the moments that I recollected, but I recognize that it is something absolutely unacceptable to do. And yeah, I appreciate calling it makeup, but it was blackface. And that is just not right. It is something that people who live with the kind of discrimination that far too many people do because of the color of their skin, or their history, or their origins, or their language, or their religion, face on a regular basis. And I didn't see that from the layers of privilege that I have. And for that, I am deeply sorry, and I apologize.
Trudeau added the revelations won't stop his re-election campaign, stating Canadians have an important choice to make on October 21st, and I trust Canadians to make the right choice. And China's foreign ministry on Thursday accused U.S. Congressional leader Nancy Pelosi of making irresponsible remarks about pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong one day after she welcomed activists from the city to the U.S. Capitol. Pelosi was joined by Republican lawmakers at a news conference Wednesday with democracy activists, including Joshua Wong and pop singer Denise Ho. She sided with their demand for fully democratic elections and thanked them for challenging the conscience of the Chinese government and the world. Chinese government spokesperson Geng Shuang said Pelosi and other American lawmakers had confused right and wrong by engaging with what he termed Hong Kong separatists. And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Speaking before the House Judiciary Committee on Thursday, Gwen Carr, the mother of Eric Garner, spoke passionately about her late son and the officer who killed him with a chokehold in 2014. In her statement, Carr emphasized how the lack of accountability of the officer and NYPD tore through her family after Garner's death.
Today, Eric Garner's mother, Gwen Carr, testified to the House Judiciary Committee at an oversight hearing on policing practices. She calls for immediate changes in legislation which would deter excessive use of force. Here's Gwen Carr.
Yes, Chairman Nadler and members of the Judiciary Committee, I thank you for having me this morning. My name is Gwen Carr. I am the mother of Eric Garner. 5 years ago, my beloved son Eric was murdered by people who were supposed to serve and protect. On July 17th, the NYPD police officers approached my son. One of them put him in an illegal chokehold. Eric cried out 11 times, "I can't breathe." 11 times he said, "I can't breathe." But those officers who were on the scene that day, they didn't seem to care. Eric died that day. There was a video that was captured the incident, including the chokehold and my son's cry saying that he couldn't breathe. This went viral around the world. So my thought is today, how come no one was held accountable? No one was held in charge for my son's death. But not only the officer that murdered my son, but all the officers who were on the scene need to stand accountable for his death that day. I will never forget that day in July. I got up that morning and I spoke to Eric. I spoke to him for about 10 minutes. And afterwards, we said our goodbyes. He said, "I love you, Mom." I said, "I love you too, Eric." Never knowing that would be our last and final conversation. My entire life was uprooted on that July day. I felt helpless in a dark place, scattered in millions of pieces. It is impossible to describe the pain that I felt that day. Losing a child is just indescribable. Having the burden of finding out exactly what happened to your child by the police who was responsible for his demise. How is a person supposed to get answers? Who does she go to for help? Most people can't even comprehend how difficult it is to suddenly lose a child and to fight for 5 years and just get an ounce of accountability. It has impacted our lives in many devastating ways. Almost 2 months ago, I lost my husband. He was my partner in every sense of the word. He fought the long fight with me, even though he wasn't in front of the cameras. He supported me, and he really supported the cause. My granddaughter, Erica, she died December 17th of a heart attack. She was only 27 years old. But when my son was murdered, she fought the good fight. She fought until she became ill. I say she died of a broken heart. These are the wounds of the seen and unseen from the police brutality. The loss of loved ones and no recourse, no accountability. The entire family is traumatized. Each and every time we enter the courtroom or watch the officers responsible for my son's death get a pay raise, or hear the Department of Justice saying they're not going to seek charges, or when an officer who is the commanding officer of the person who was on the scene when my son was murdered said it was not a big deal that Eric laid on the ground DOA. I come before you today not only to share my son's story or the long quest of justice that we've been seeking for 5 years, but I urge you to take immediate action to imply the national changes and standards towards policing. In 2015, I stood with Representative Hakeem Jeffries as we introduced the bill that would make chokeholds illegal under federal civil rights law. Once the bill is reintroduced, this season I call for you to support and vote for legislation. The Excessive Use of Force Prevention Act of 2019, Please vote for it.
Gwen Carr testifying today at the House Judiciary Committee on Policing Practices.
And WBAI's Linda Perry provided that report. In July, 5 years after Garner's death, the Department of Justice decided it would not seek federal charges against Daniel Pantaleo, the officer who put Eric Garner in the chokehold that ended his life. Last month, the New York Police Department finally fired Pantaleo following a judge's recommendation. And the New York Times is reporting that a whistleblower complaint at the heart of the showdown between the intelligence community and Congress involved multiple acts involving the president. The Times says one of the purported acts had Trump making a commitment with an unnamed foreign leader over the phone. Inspector General Michael Atkinson of the American Intelligence Community briefed Congress on Thursday, but provided few details about the complaint. According to lawmakers, he's expected to appear before Congress next week. Adam Schiff is a Democrat and chair of the Select Committee on Intelligence. He says Congress wasn't informed of the whistleblower's complaint as required by law.
We were informed of this fact after the 7-day period in which the director has to review it and submit it to Congress had expired. No complaint was provided, and the Inspector General felt it necessary to inform the Congress that that complaint was being withheld. In the absence of the actions, and I want to thank the Inspector General, in the absence of his actions and coming to our committee, we might not have even known there was a whistleblower complaint alleging an urgent concern. We will be releasing the Inspector General's letters, but I want to read one sentence from them. Mr. Atkinson wrote, "I set forth the reasons for my concluding that the subject matter involved in the complainant's disclosure not only falls within the DNI's jurisdiction, but relates to one of the most significant and important of the DNI's responsibilities to the American people." This is what's being withheld from Congress right now. We do know that the Department of Justice has been involved in the decision to withhold that information from Congress. We do not know, because we cannot get an answer to the question about whether the White House is also involved in preventing this information from coming to Congress. We do not have the complaint. We do not know whether the press reports are accurate or inaccurate about the contents of that complaint. But what I do know is this: if in a matter within the jurisdiction of the Director of National Intelligence, you have an employee of that community or a contractor or a detailee who follows the law and makes a complaint, and it is possible for the subject of that complaint to essentially quash the complaint or keep it from Congress, then this system is badly broken. Now, I don't think this is a problem of the law. I think the law is written very clearly. I think the law is just fine. The problem lies elsewhere. And we're determined to do everything we can to determine what this urgent concern is, to make sure that the national security is protected, and to make sure that this whistleblower is protected.
Schiff says an unknown institution in the government is apparently obstructing Congress from hearing from the anonymous whistleblower.
We also know that there are other institutions involved that are preventing us from getting the complaint. And whether this is pressure brought by the White House, whether this is the Director of National Intelligence feeling that he is straitjacketed by this opinion of the Department of Justice, whether the Department of Justice is coordinating its activities with either the White House or the subject of the complaint, we don't know. But given the Inspector General said this is urgent, it can't wait, which is a profound concern that we have over what we have seen over the last year, which is a concerted strategy to run out the clock on any information getting to Congress. Here, where it's urgent, that is simply not an option.
Schiff implied it's the president who may be at the heart of the problem.
I believe that there is an effort to prevent this information getting to Congress. And if the assertion is accurate that the Department of Justice has made and the DNI has affirmed that this involves a potentially privileged communication, then at one level or another, it likely involves either the president or people around him.
Mr. Chairman.
Meanwhile, CNN reports the White House and the Justice Department have advised the nation's top intelligence agency that a controversial complaint, this same controversial complaint involving President Donald Trump, isn't governed by laws covering intelligence whistleblowers. The Director of National Intelligence has not allowed lawmakers access to the complaint. And in more national news, even as cannabis is fast entering the national pharmacopoeia, little is scientifically known of weed and how it acts within the body. The federal government still considers marijuana an illegal drug, but more than 30 states allow its use for a range of medical problems and 10 with complete legalization. Now the U.S. government plans to spend $3 million to clear the air for good. The money is not going to look into why marijuana gets you high. The 9 grants announced Thursday are for work on CBD, the popular ingredient showing up in cosmetics and foods. Research into THC, the part of the plant that provides the buzz, was excluded. And while the U.S. embarks on its marijuana legalization experiment, millions are finding it harder than ever to pay for the pharmaceutical drugs that keep them alive. In February, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland diagnosed the problem.
One of the most pressing challenges facing our country and working families is the rising costs of prescription drugs. Drug prices clearly are out of control. We've all heard the horror stories of families having to choose between paying for necessary medications like insulin or paying the mortgage, rent, or putting food on the table. In my home state of Maryland, the list price for insulin is 21 times that of Australia, 14 times the price in the United Kingdom, and 12 times the cost in Canada. Uninsured people living in my district, 6 times more for an EpiPen than uninsured, not unemployed, 6 times for an EpiPen more than Australians pay, and 9 times more the cost in Great Britain. That is just unsustainable, unacceptable. American taxpayers support prescription drug innovation through government grants and R&D tax credits to drug companies, so Americans shouldn't have to pay many times more what people in other countries pay.
Healthcare is a top issue on voters' minds before the 2020 presidential elections, beating out immigration and gun control. Dana Brown is director of the Next System Project, an initiative that deals with systemic problems in the U.S. economy. She says life-saving drugs are being priced out of reach, and it's time to do something about the problem.
The United States pays the highest prescription drug prices in the world, and our drug market is responsible for the majority of the profits of the pharmaceutical industry. So high prices are a systemic problem on generics as well as on brand name drugs. For instance, there are about 500 generics for which there's no competitor on the market, and those drugs can be priced at essentially monopoly prices, even though they're now generic.
Maybe the real answer to this is to cut down our addiction, so to speak, to all these pharmaceutical drugs.
Let's make a distinction between essential medications and other medications, right? There are medications like insulin. If you are a type 1 diabetic, your body simply lacks the ability to produce insulin. If you do not take it externally, you die, right? So this, you know, diabetics are not addicted to insulin. They don't take too much of it for fun. It's not a drug that gets abused in any way, right? It's a drug some people need to live. And there are a lot of drugs that we can say that about, right? There are lots of antibiotics that we need to live if we get certain infections. And there are kinds of infections that are on the rise for a lot of reasons. And that are prevalent in the hospital setting. And if we don't have new antibiotics, we are risking life and limb.
What alternatives we can come up with to fix this kind of system where money is taken over, sort of, it seems, from what you're saying?
We've been working on one model for a sort of structural alternative, which is a public option in the pharmaceutical sector. The idea is that supersedes the need for individual reforms for each of these separate issues, shortages, declining innovation, you know, rising safety issues, and provides a way to kind of transform the whole sector. So we propose a full supply chain public option. That means research and development, manufacturing, and wholesale distribution. And we think it's a way that we can begin to get gains for our health, the economy and the democracy.
Mm-hmm. So would this go hand in hand with Bernie's ideas or some of these ideas of Medicare for all?
The model that we propose is not dependent on any other reforms in the healthcare sector, whether that be reforms to our insurance structure, antitrust action, reforms to intellectual property, but it could be complementary to many of them. One of the things that we found is that we could start to make real gains for people's health and for the economy, even without any action on the federal level. We propose that states, municipalities, or even regions could form public manufacturing companies, which could begin to develop low-cost generic drugs. And this could happen without any action at the federal level. So I think, especially when people are frustrated by a lack of action by Washington, it's great to know that there are things that are in our power, right, already to do that to begin to change the results for our health and for the economy.
Are there any states or any localities that are already trying to do this?
So this would be new in the United States, but it's based on a lot of research in case studies of publicly owned pharmaceutical companies in a number of countries around the world, from Sweden to Brazil, China, India, Thailand, and several others, but also looking at public enterprise in other sectors in the United States. For instance, the entire state of Nebraska is served by public and community-owned electric utilities. I took public transportation to work this morning, like millions of Americans, right? We have a lot of experience in public provision of public goods and services. It's just new to us as a country to start thinking about health as a public good. But there's lots of evidence to show that we could do this for pharmaceuticals and that it might save us a lot of money, but also be very important to public health, where the private industry is simply not producing certain types of medications or producing them at costs that we simply can't afford.
What kind of, though, just briefly, what kind of medications are you referring to that they're not producing? Or
insulin's a great one where there's some affordability issues, right? This is a drug that was developed in a public lab almost a century ago, and where the scientists who developed it sold their U.S. patents for $1 a piece, expressing their interest in keeping it affordable forever, and yet we have 20-somethings dying because they can't afford their prescription. But there are also things where even industry officials have said, for instance, that they are not incentivized. They have no incentive to develop new antibiotics because antibiotics are meant to be taken for a short period of time and are curative, which means there's not a lot of money to be made. They're also not developing drugs for what we think of as neglected tropical diseases. So diseases that are prevalent in hot areas with poor people, but that are becoming increasingly prevalent in the United States due to globalization and travel and whatnot. So there's certain kinds of drugs that aren't the money makers, right? If you're not supposed to take them forever for the rest of your life, there may not be the same market incentive to develop those. And those are where I think people across the political spectrum could understand there's more incentive for the public to develop those sorts of medications.
Anything you would like to add?
With the opioid epidemic in particular, with open cases against Purdue Pharma, it's an extraordinary one-time opportunity to channel some of the ill-gotten gains from this horrific crisis into something transformational. You know, it could be used to seed a public option that could begin to produce the drugs that we really need and at affordable prices. I think it's time to think big.
Dana Brown is director of the Next System Project, an initiative that deals with systemic problems in the U.S. economy. And finally, the Justice Department announced this week it has filed a lawsuit against Edward Snowden that would recover all proceeds from his recently released memoir, Permanent Record. Snowden's memoir was allegedly not submitted to the CIA or NSA for pre-publication review. The suit does not seek to block the release of Snowden's memoir because that's covered under the First Amendment. Speaking with a German reporter, Snowden had this to say.
So I don't mind talking about myself, and honestly, when I set out to write a book, it was not initially a memoir. I was going to write a book about figures from history, such as Ossietzky, such as Harriet Tubman, the United States, who helped runaway slaves. People who were figures of conscience that were breaking the law in order to serve a greater good. But the publisher said, of course, we'd like something more personal. And so this is where I realized that same method of storytelling was maybe something that the conservative public interest here. So this book Well, it is certainly a memoir of how I became who I am as a person. It's actually larger. It's a dual history. It's the story of a person, but more centrally, and I think more importantly, it's the story of time and a change in technology, and perhaps an argument for how we can retrieve so much of the power that has been stolen from us, both by corporations and governments. The greatest regret of my life is how easily I was transformed into a tool of factions in my country's government. Not even the government itself, but factions within my country's government, who were pursuing this neoconservative and then neoliberal strategy to dominate the world. And I did this quite unskeptically because I grew up in a culture and in a family that believed the United States government was the greatest force for good in the history of the world. In a free country, you're not supposed to trust a government. The government is always supposed to be fighting a losing battle to persuade the people of a free society that the authority that they seek, that the spending they desire, that the policy that they like is necessary. And they should win just by the skin of their teeth, by the tiniest margin, convince us to agree with them. Because then we have a government that only does what it must. Then we have a government that does what is necessary to protect the common welfare, right? Instead of doing everything that it can.
And that's intelligence whistleblower Edward Snowden. His book, Permanent Record, was released by Henry Holt. And that's some of the news for Thursday, September 19th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Oliver Sampson. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.